unnecessarily. I mean, the sort of where I was, the person that was hit the worst, literally in front of me, was a member of the press. And DHS did, you know, admit to that. Like, there was a member of the press. I said they weren't being aggressive. They had press credentials and a lot of cameras. So it was pretty, it's very, very jarring.
So what happened to the restaurant? Who got arrested?
I don't know. I believe it's still closed. I haven't gone back. So they're locally owned, but it's a chain around other places in Southern Arizona. What the claim was is that it was a raid having to do with taxes. But again, the show of force in front, like in the middle of the community, was very, very concerning, very aggressive to everybody.
Adelita Grijalva, I want to ask you a question on another issue. You were the final vote needed on the discharge petition that calls for the release of the Epstein files. Other Republicans joined you, and among them was Marjorie Taylor Greene. I wanted to turn now to a clip of Marjorie Taylor Greene. She was interviewed on 60 Minutes, and she's talking about the threats she received for bucking the president, and how serious, in fact, that they are. Let's go to Marjorie Taylor Greene speaking on 60 Minutes.
After President Trump called me a traitor, I got a pipe bomb threat on my house, and then I got several direct death threats on my son.
On your son?
On my son.
You say the president put your life in danger. You blame him. You say he fueled a hotbed of threats against me, and that you blame him for the threats against your son.
The subject line for the direct death threats on my son was his words, Marjorie Traitor Green. Those are death threats directly fueled by President Trump.
So that's Marjorie Taylor Greene saying that she's receiving death, or her son has received death threats because of what President Trump said about her, calling her Marjorie Traitor Greene. If you can talk about what he is so angry about, even though he campaigned on the release of these documents, where these documents stand right now.
Yeah. So as I understand it, they are every little piece of the puzzle in as far as the files have to be approved by a federal judge in order for that investigation to be released. And so it is a longer process than I think any of us want to see. And it's also, what very much concerns me in what Marjorie Taylor Greene is saying, that as an elected person in any position, you shouldn't have to worry about that kind of fear. And she's getting a glimpse of what many of my colleagues have been living with since Trump's been in office and before then. These targeted attacks are incredibly scary. And Trump had done, up until the point that he gave permission to both representatives and senators to vote for the release of the Epstein files, had literally done everything in his power to obstruct their release. And so I don't know what he's afraid of, that the community, that our nation are going to find out. But I do think that there are implications very high up. I was listening to your show earlier on how often, this family, the Trump family, how they're enriching themselves off the presidency is a very scary time for all of us and for democracy, right?
Right. Donald Trump Jr.'s company getting a $600 million plus contract with the Pentagon, among other things. Let me end by asking you about the massive health premium increases that could soon kick in for millions of Americans as Republican Speaker Mike Johnson races to finalize a Republican health care plan, supposedly this week. Republicans want to have an alternative to vote on as Democrats attack them for allowing Obamacare subsidies to expire. House Republicans are reportedly angry at Johnson over his failure to lead on this issue, as well as the affordability crisis, which likely impacted recent election victories for Democrats. He also helped the Trump administration to block the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files. And I want to ask you about this Republican uprising, if there is one, particularly led by Republican women like Marjorie Taylor Greene, like Nancy Mace and others, if you can talk about this.
Well, they're hearing from their communities about the incredible cost of maintaining insurance for your families. So, you know, that's why Democrats were holding so strong on health care, because it is going to impact millions of people. The Republicans have had 15 years to come up with a better alternative. Since ACA started, all they have done is criticize it. And here we are, December 8th, and they're talking about rolling out a plan. People are already looking at those premiums right now. So as an individual person on the ACA, to cover me is $760 a month. To cover me and my children, it's going to be $1,400 a month. My husband works at a local community college here, and it costs $700 a month for him to cover me, himself, and our three children. Like, this is becoming, it's a situation that's untenable. And what people are going to do, because they can't afford it, is they're going to forego health insurance. And the impact to our system in general is going to be devastating. There are 5 rural hospitals in southern Arizona that are already talking about closing their doors because the wave of people coming in without the resource and reimbursement is going to be devastating. So we have a really big problem to fix here in our healthcare system. And to talk about these Band-Aid solutions right now, you know, in December, when premiums are going up right around the corner. It's just, it's past time. And I think that the criticism to Speaker Johnson is just.
Well, we'll certainly continue to follow this week. Adelita Grijalva, U.S. Representative for Arizona's 7th Congressional District, representing Tucson and beyond, the first Latina to represent Arizona in Congress, the daughter of the former and late Congressmember Raul Grijalva. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney General Pam Bondi's ordered the FBI to compile a list of what the Justice Department is calling domestic terrorist organizations. Last week, Bondi sent a memo to all federal prosecutors and law enforcement agencies targeting a wide range of people, including those who hold what she calls, quote, extreme views in favor of mass migration and open borders, adherence to radical gender ideology, anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, or anti-Christianity, unquote. The memo also targets people who show, quote, hostility towards traditional views on family, religion, and morality, unquote. The investigative journalist Ken Klippenstein published a copy of Bondi's memo on his Substack page on Saturday. Klippenstein notes Bondi's language echoes a national security presidential memorandum issued by President Trump, known as NSPM 7, to target nonprofits and activists. Trump signed the directive in September in the wake of the murder of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk. Ken Klippenstein, thanks so much for being with us from Madison, Wisconsin. Why don't you tell us how you got a hold of this memo?
Well, it was provided to me by somebody who I can't really say much more than had access to it. And what it was an implementation order for that NSPM 7 directive from President Trump, which essentially targets anyone who isn't MAGA. At first, I looked at it and thought, oh, this is targeting the left. But then you see these so-called indicators of terrorism, things like anti-Christian sentiment, anti-American sentiment. And I realized that's not just the left. That's anyone who isn't a Trump supporter.
So explain the significance of this, Ken Klippenstein.
It essentially takes NSPM 7, which advances the view that a major threat of terrorism is coming from these, you know, anti-Trump sentiments, and it puts it into effect. It uses tools available to the federal government and federal law enforcement in particular. For example, it directs the FBI to go through its past half decade or so of intelligence on Antifa and on some of these other groups I've been talking about, and tells them to make criminal cases around those and to circulate intelligence about it. And part of that intelligence production effort involves soliciting tips from the public, getting people to narc on their fellow citizens who are evincing this anti-Trump sentiment. So in one case, it tells the FBI to upgrade and kind of supercharge its tip system so that they can get this flow of information coming in from informants all over the country reporting on threats like these.
You believe?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that again? It cut out for just a second.
Who is the architect of this memo, do you believe, of the NSPM-7?
I would say it's not a person so much as an incident, which was the murder of Charlie Kirk, as national security officials described to me shortly after the murder. The very next day, there was a war room convened by the White House. And I think kind of unofficially taking point on this was President Trump's Homeland Security advisor, Stephen Miller. And he kind of orchestrated, along with all these other national security appointees, how are we going to respond to this? And the decision was made that we would make anti-Trump sentiment tantamount to this terrorist threat, and we were going to prosecute it as such. So I guess I would say, if I was to point to one single person, I would say Stephen Miller. But this is really an attitude held by a lot of people in the administration, which I think is genuine fear in the wake of that shooting, that something like that might happen to them. And so we have to create a response. And what that is essentially the same sort of response to 9/11. But in this case, it's in it's directed at Americans.
Ken, is money involved with this?
Yeah, absolutely. So it directs the Treasury Department to audit taxes and to try to find, the administration seems convinced that there's some shadowy foreign group or financiers for a lot of the sentiments I was describing before, and Antifa in particular. And so it authorizes them to go through nonprofits taxes and to try to find evidence of something which there's no public evidence exists.
But is there a reward being offered, like if someone calls an FBI tip line?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's another thing that this implementation order directs. It provides for a funding system to reward people that provide these tips that I was describing before. It's basically a bounty system for anti-Trump thought and reporting on it.
And it goes back retroactively 5 years?
Yeah, the FBI right now, pursuant to this order, is digging through all of its intelligence to find whatever they can, going back to the Biden administration, that can be used to help make these cases.
So the memo targets organizations, not only what formal NGOs, but also book clubs, community, mutual networks, mutual aid networks, online forums.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it uses the phrase organizations and entities, which can mean individuals. So again, it can't be overstated how sweeping a directive like this is. This isn't targeted. And to the extent that it's being reported as directed at Antifa, I think it's important to remember, you know, Antifa may not exist as such, but it includes a lot more than that. It also describes people opposed to immigration enforcement, which if you look at polling is like, you know, the way in which immigration enforcement has been rolled out under this administration, that could describe half the country or more of it. So this is really much bigger than just Antifa. And to the extent that Antifa means anything, the administration defines it in its own way, which is different than how a lot of people would define Antifa. So it's really important to understand that.
I mean, we just did a segment on the Pentagon bombing boats without evidence of them being, as the Trump administration calls them, narco-terrorists. They're talking about foreign terrorists, so-called. So here you're talking about a domestic terrorist network. Are we talking about no trial, no paid-for accusations? How does this work?
Yeah. I mean, the business of counterterrorism is a very ugly business. It is essentially pre-crime in the sense that you are authorized to go and make investigations without the usual predicate that you would need of someone having committed a crime or finding evidence that suggests someone committed a crime. In counterterrorism, the theory behind it is that the threat is so great that we need to suspend those ordinary evidentiary standards for premising an investigation. And instead, all you need are these so-called indicators. And the Trump administration is defining those indicators as a lot of these groups we've just been describing, which can apply to millions and millions of Americans. These are very mainstream views, opposition to immigration enforcement and the way in which it's been carried out this year. So the dragnet has gotten far wider. I mean, after 9/11, these tools were pointed at groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And it, unfortunately, to some extent, just American Muslims caught up in this dragnet, but they've widened this to include far larger sets of people. And so what we're really seeing is the global war on terror coming home and becoming a domestic war on terror.
Ken Klippenstein, I want to thank you for being with us, investigative reporter. We'll link to your latest piece, FBI Making List of American Extremists, Leak Memo Reveals. Next up, we speak with former EPA official Judith Enck. Her new book, The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. Stay with us.
By the blackjack, baby came a-walking through the woods, singing so loud and gaily. He whistled and he sang till the wild woods rang. And he charmed the heart of a lady, charmed the heart of a lady. He charmed the heart of a lady, charmed the heart of a lady.
Folk music Nora Brown performing at Brooklyn Folk Festival. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. That's the title of a new book by Judith Enck, former regional administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency, now president of Beyond Plastics, joining us to talk about pollution in the environment, our bodies as well, and moving beyond plastics. Her book's release comes as the United Nations efforts to negotiate a legally binding global treaty on plastic pollution have slowed, and plastics were low on the agenda at the COP30 UN Climate Summit in Brazil. Next week, the seventh session of the UN Environment Assembly is set to begin in Nairobi, Kenya, with the theme Advancing Sustainable Solutions for a Resilient Planet. Judith Enck, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. So the title is The Problem with Plastic. Explain what it is.
So many problems. It should have been plural. Plastics is a climate change issue because it's made from fossil fuels and 16,000 different chemicals. It's a health issue because plastics, little pieces of microplastics, have been found in many parts of our bodies. This is an environmental justice issue because plastics are produced in primarily low-income communities of color, places like Cancer Alley in Louisiana. It's also a consumer deception issue because the industry has been telling us we can recycle plastic, which is not true. And finally, the issue that really drew me to this is we're turning our ocean into a watery landfill with so much plastic getting into the ocean. It's about two giant garbage trucks every minute is dumped into the ocean. And, you know, the ocean is 71% of the world's surface and a major protein source for many of us around the world.
So what happens then to the plastic dumped in the ocean?
It gets exposed to sunlight. Then the wave action is almost like a paper cutter. So one plastic water bottle, for instance, becomes hundreds or thousands of little pieces of microplastic, which are eaten by fish, marine life, and it is really an ocean emergency.
Chemicals found in plastics have been associated with cancer, nervous system damage, hormone disruption, fertility issues. Explain the issues.
16,000 different chemicals are used to make plastic, including PFAS chemicals, the forever chemicals. And every plastic product has a different chemical combination. So it's hard to say precisely this plastic food wrapper, for instance, is linked to this health outcome. But we know that many of these chemicals, as you say, cause cancer. They're reproductive toxins. And my big concern is the plastic packaging that touches our food and our beverage, especially if it's ever heated.
Okay, so that goes to the issue of microwave. You say don't microwave in plastic, but how many plastic containers say microwave safe?
Yeah, it shouldn't. You should not put any food containers in the microwave because the chemicals very likely are leaching into your food. You can kind of taste it, right? And definitely don't use black plastic because that's from recycled electronic waste. So this is so...
Wait a second. Just the color, the plastic, the color of it means it's recycled electronic waste?
Very likely. If you have like a black plastic takeout container, when you get home, take it right out of the container and put it on your plate. I really try to avoid black plastic. There have been good studies on this. But any kind of plastic, you want to avoid heating.
What about putting it in your dishwasher?
Not a great idea, particularly if you're using it for food.
Because?
Because the chemicals will leach because it's exposed to heat.
Can you talk about microplastics?
Microplastics are 5 millimeters or less, teeny tiny pieces of plastic. Scientists have found microplastics in our blood, our kidneys, our lungs. They've been found in heart arteries, and if it's attached to plaque, you have an increased risk of heart attack, stroke, premature death. Unfortunately, it's crossed the blood-brain barrier and has been linked to Alzheimer's and other neurological diseases recently. We need these studies repeated. We also know that microplastics have been found in the human placenta and breast milk, so our babies are being born pre-polluted. And when I talk to legislators that are male, I mentioned that it's also been found in testicles, and they start to pay attention.
You know, we just came from the UN Climate Summit, the climate summit in the Amazon in Brazil. There was a lot of activism there, but very little around plastics.
Yeah, you know, plastics traditionally were made from chemicals and oil, now from chemicals and a waste product of fracking, ethane. So plastics is very much a climate issue. We did a report looking at production, use, and disposal of plastics. The greenhouse gas emissions are the equivalent of about 116 coal-fired power plants. There's a separate UN process going on with plastics, but unfortunately, because of the positions of the United States and Saudi Arabia, that process did not reach a conclusion, but it is ongoing.
So if you can talk about who's lobbying for plastics and what you think needs to be done, because your book has the word saving ourselves and the planet before it's too late.
Yeah, we chose those words purposefully. So this is a political science issue, not a science issue. So we're up against Exxon, Shell, Amazon, Dow Chemical, the American Chemistry Council. You show up even at a city council meeting, and these guys from Washington come flying in with their expensive suits saying why we shouldn't, for instance, ban plastic bags. In Albany, we're working on a comprehensive packaging reduction law. We were outnumbered by corporate lobbyists 4-1. Still came very close to passing a packaging reduction bill. So when you're working on plastics, you're going up against the chemical, fossil fuel, plastics industry, and consumer brands. But progress is being made all across the country. People are paying attention to the issue. And I want to emphasize that about half of all plastics have been manufactured worldwide in the last 18 years. So this is relatively new. I actually remember 18 years ago. So I am hopeful that if people work not just to reduce plastic in their own lives, but get into the political arena, work on new laws, new regulations to reduce plastic, it's in our own self-interest. This is not an ideological issue. In fact, when there's polling on plastic, there's bipartisan support to reduce plastic production. We just need to get more people in the arena saying, we don't want babies, for instance, born with microplastics while they're in the placenta and then consuming breast milk.
Judith Henk, you were a regional administrator of the EPA. Talk about Trump's attacks on the EPA and regulations. ProPublica has a new piece out today. Under former chemical industry insiders, Trump EPA nearly doubles the amount of formaldehyde considered safe to inhale.
This is the worst EPA has ever been. They're no longer protecting the environment. They're no longer protecting public health. You have people from the chemical industry at EPA making policy. Lee Zeldin, the head of the EPA, is the worst EPA administrator in the history of the agency. It's going to take decades to rebuild. Places like Cancer Alley, where plastic is produced in Texas, people are being poisoned every day, and the EPA is doing nothing to protect health. It's really a national embarrassment and something where the states need to step in, and we haven't seen that yet.
The California Attorney General has sued ExxonMobil for its recycling claims.
Yeah, Attorney General Rob Bonta sued ExxonMobil for not telling the truth about plastics recycling in September of 2024. The plastics industry tells us, don't worry about all the plastics you're using, just put it in the recycling bin. But plastics recycling has been an abysmal failure. People should keep recycling paper, metal, glass, cardboard, but the plastic recycling rate is only 5 to 6% nationwide because plastics are made from so many different chemicals, different colors, different plastic polymers that they cannot be recycled together, unlike other material.
Talk about the policies more around that make a difference from single-use plastic bans and explain what that is, bottle bills, extended producer responsibility laws to reuse and refill systems.
So our book, The Problem with Plastic, has model bills that people can work on at the local or state level. We are alert enough not to be trying this at the national level. All we're doing in Washington is playing whack-a-mole, trying to beat back bad things. But communities can ban plastic bags. You can have policies called skip the stuff. So when you get takeout food, you don't automatically get the plastic utensils and the straws. You have to ask for it. The bottle bill is the first bill I ever worked on as a college student with NYPERG. It puts a refundable deposit on soda and beer and water bottles. You bring it back. And that's the only recycling success story with plastics, is the plastic bottles do get recycled. But the major policy reform we need is called extended producer responsibility, where companies that produce all this plastic need to take some responsibility. We have a model bill that takes it further and requires, for instance, that all single-use packaging be reduced by 50% over 10 years, and that the most toxic chemicals used in plastics, like PFAS chemicals, lead, cadmium, formaldehyde, not be allowed to be used in packaging.
I want to end with where you started, your dedication. You write, by design, low-income people in communities of color bear the burden of plastics. The destructive web of plastics gathers in their neighborhoods, rivers, air, and bodies. We dedicate this book to those living in the shadow of plastics facilities in Louisiana, Texas, Appalachia, and elsewhere, in the sincere belief that they should live in a world beyond plastics and that such a world is within our reach. Final 20 seconds.
Thank you, Amy. I mean, the environmental justice issues are quite severe. People are getting sick living near these plastic production facilities. Johns Hopkins did a study saying the cancer rate in Cancer Alley is 7 times the national average. So even if you don't live in those communities, by reducing plastic and getting laws to reduce plastic, we're helping our sisters and brothers in Cancer Alley in Texas and Appalachia.
Judith Henk, I want to thank you for being with us. Former EPA regional administrator, president of Beyond Plastics. Her new book is The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. This is another edition of Democracy Now!
Hi there, this is Jan Arden, and if you're listening to something fabulous, Well, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
For many, a career in music is a dream come true. However, the reality is that many people in the Canadian music industry do not have access to medical benefits and financial aid. This is especially true for our music industry veterans, and it's why the Unison Fund created the Slate Family Foundation Legacy Program. To learn more on how you can support legacy artists and musicians who are coping with unexpected or chronic illness, visit unisonfund.ca.